Welcome to Let's Talk ETFs. I'm your host, Jonathan Liss, and I've been closely tracking the ETF space for more than 13 years through a variety of roles here at SeekingAlpha.com. Each week, a different guest and I will take an in-depth look at a particular aspect of the rapidly evolving exchange-traded fund space, with a focus on how investors can best utilize ETFs to reach their investing goals. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Nothing said here should be taken as investment advice. All opinions expressed on this show are those of the individuals expressing them alone. A full set of disclosures will be included at the end of this show. You can subscribe to Let's Talk ETFs on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. For reference purposes, this podcast is being recorded on the morning of Wednesday, January 13th, 2021. My guest today is Seeking Alpha contributor Books Research, aka Dan Victor. Dan runs the Conviction Dossier Investing Ideas service here at the Seeking Alpha Marketplace. Books is a CFA charterholder with 15 years of professional experience in capital markets and investment management at major financial institutions. He now works as an independent investor and market strategist. As I just mentioned, Books Research's marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha, Conviction Dossier, takes his data-driven fundamentals first approach to an entirely new level. In addition to the steady stream of stock and ETF ideas he posts on Seeking Alpha and through his marketplace service for his subscribers, subscribers to Conviction Dossier gain access to model portfolios, a regularly updated watch list, industry tracker spreadsheets, video commentary, an active chat room, and much more. You can subscribe to Conviction Dossier either by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for Conviction Dossier there, or by typing Conviction Dossier or Books Research, that's B-O-O-X Research, into the search bar at the top of the site. All right, enough of an intro here. Let's get into it, Books. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
So I'd love to just jump right in here and have you tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself. When did you first become interested in investing? How long have you been doing this for and in what capacity?
Right. So, you know, I'm in my mid-30s and I've been doing this really my whole life professionally for the past, you know, 15 years or so. I've always had a passion for financial markets. I think that, you know, going back to the time I was a teenager, you know, just the idea of, you know, you own 100 shares of stock, it goes up one penny, you make a dollar. There's just something beautiful about that. And I've always been fascinated by financial markets, you know, the idea of risk, you know, and I think that I have a degree in economics, I have an MBA, and all this is really, you know, just it's a process of learning. And I think that that's what I really love is, you know, there's always something to learn. And you know, the level of knowledge just keeps increasing, and I think you can use experience to your advantage. So it's really a passion of mine, and it's something that I'm really excited about.
Yeah, sure. And I think it shows in a lot of the work you put out, both on Seeking Alpha and through your marketplace service specifically. So you cover a mix of individual stocks and exchange traded funds for your service. And the reality is, many, maybe even most investors kind of go all in on either buying single stocks for their portfolio, generally more of a bottoms up kind of approach, or of taking more of a macro top down approach and buying exchange traded funds or mutual funds. I guess in the past, really not that many people, at least of a certain age category, doing that anymore. And really, you don't see all that many people mixing stocks and ETFs together. So I'm curious, just in your view, what the right mix here is and what it takes for an investor to be sufficiently diversified.
Right. So, you know, I think you're right. Obviously, there's investors comes in all different, you know, shapes and sizes. And I think that, you know, one of the lessons I've learned is that, you know, there really is no, you know, right or wrong approach. I think people can be successful, you know, in a lot of different, you know, methods of investing. And you know, what I believe is that having a diversified portfolio is obviously, you know, important. I think ETFs are great for that, right? So, you know, you don't have to worry about a company, you know, a company risk or some major headline that can destroy your portfolio overnight. But I think that there is room for having, you know, a mix of both ETFs. And when there is an interesting stock you like, or you see, you know, something in the market, you know, I think that there's always room in a portfolio for these types of ideas. You know, so that being said, the idea here is that I like ETFs for maybe kind of long-term strategic exposure. Okay. That's something that you can buy and hold over the long run that you're going to, you know, really not mess around with too much, maybe continue add, average in, you know, keep investing and maybe, you know, take some more like, you know, short-term or tactical positions on stocks, because, you know, I believe I consider myself kind of a semi-active investor. So I have positions that I hold over the long run. But I think that, you know, part of the fun in investing and trading is some of these more, you know, short-term opportunities over, you know, months and, you know, maybe a year or so, that I think that that's where, you know, stocks can be interesting. And in the context of a diversified portfolio, you know, it's, I believe that, you know, having a small position in some riskier assets is, it can be appropriate.
Yeah, I totally agree. And from my own experience, I definitely take, let's say, 90% of my longer term investments, whether it's for myself or my kids' college accounts or my parents' non-tax deferred account, which I keep an eye on for them, or friends that I've just kind of done a favor for and helped out. And I really am looking for those core beta building blocks, and those are going to be exchange traded funds. You're not going to get the diversification characteristics of an exchange traded fund, and particularly a broad based one, whether it's something like an SPY or a QQQ, or whether you want to go even beyond that and look at some of these iShares or Vanguard funds like VTI, Total Market Fund, or like ACWI, All Country World Index ETF from iShares. So those are going to be the core positions. But, and you know, I host this podcast and I love ETFs, but the most fun I have is with that 10% of the portfolio that I'm buying and selling either individual stocks with, or way more niche kinds of exchange traded funds where maybe I'm not taking on that single company risk. But for example, if you buy a very sector or thematic specific fund, some of the ones I own are things like eBiz, which is a global X e-commerce ETF, Cyber, which is First Trust cybersecurity ETF. These are actually pretty directed plays, and a single piece of legislation, for example, or a single hack on the US military can actually tank a small fund like that only has 20 or 30 holdings in it, in the same way that a single stock can sell off after a bad earnings report or something. So I definitely take the point that there really is room for mixing both core kinds of holdings together, along with whether they're more niche exchange traded funds or individual stocks. It could be a lot of fun and also can be very profitable in a way that holding something that has 5,000 positions in it is not necessarily going to be. So I'd love to get into your research process here in terms of how you identify ideas. When you go about finding new ideas, what does that look like? Are you starting out with quantitative kinds of screens and overlays? Are there people you're following where ideas come from? Are you combing through filings? What does the process look like exactly?
Right. So I consider myself a top-down investor, you know, so looking at, I like to start with the big picture, kind of macro themes, you know, seeing what are really not only what are the major drivers of the market, but, you know, across asset classes, you know, what's moving. And I think the question I try to answer is, why is a certain asset class outperforming or inversely underperforming, right? So I think that's where I start with. And obviously, you know, you look back at, you know, in recent years, you know, tech has been a big winner. You know, energy, materials in the last like decade underperformed. And I think that, you know, obviously the goal is to always kind of, you know, look ahead and see, okay, well, where is the opportunity? Where is there going to be a rotation? Okay, where will these trends, you know, change? And also maybe try to see what the market is missing. Okay, why, you know, maybe the market is a little bit too you know, too bearish on emerging markets, or, you know, maybe they're a little bit too optimistic on tech, right? So I think those are the types of questions I ask myself, and I keep, you know, and I keep questioning.
Yeah, sure. So let's get into your top ETF picks for 2021. And again, this doesn't necessarily mean that you're recommending that these be people's top positions inside of their portfolio, obviously, or even that they're appropriate for any particular individual. I like to remind listeners that all investing advice is specific for individuals. And so we don't offer investing advice here, because without actually knowing what any of the listeners need to accomplish, or what their tolerance for risk is, and a variety of other factors, it's impossible to be making specific recommendations. But in terms of where you're seeing things right now, you mentioned emerging markets briefly there. So let's start out with your first pick here. Which fund is it?
The iShares Core MSCI Emerging Markets ETF, the ticker is IEMG. And first off, you know, what's interesting here is that IEMG in the iShares fund family is really a kind of a sister fund to EEM, okay, which is the separate iShares Emerging Markets fund. And I think that, you know, while there are some similarities and some overlap, I think IEMG is a little bit more interesting. And curiously, IEMG actually has you know, better performance, a lower expense ratio, and I think there are some advantages, you know, as a broad diversification for emerging markets equities, right? So that's I'm bullish on emerging markets, mm-hmm. and IEMG as a long-term holding, I think you know, it's a great way to gain exposure to this really important market segment that I believe, you know, can benefit from several bullish tailwinds over the next couple of years. And I think that this is a market segment that, going back over the last decade, has really underperformed. Obviously, you know, compared to U.S. equities, considering, you know, the whole story of you know, the market leaders in tech, where emerging markets kind of lacks that a little bit, especially, you know, outside of, you know, FANG. So there was a big commodity, you know, bust, energy, you know, crash going back to, you know, 2012, 2014. And I think emerging markets there's a turnaround opportunity here, so it's an area that that I like a lot, and IEMG is a great way to play that.
Sure. So yeah. So you were referring there to a companion fund to EEM, iShares MSCI Emerging Markets ETF. I remember maybe a decade ago, before IEMG was rolled out as part of iShares core offerings, they moved over to that. It was basically EEM and VWO in the space. The funds were significantly more expensive. I believe EEM is still significantly more expensive than IEMG. We're talking about an expense ratio of almost 70 basis points. IEMG is considerably cheaper than that. And I believe part of the reason for the stickiness in the fund is probably just people that don't want to create a large taxable event. I think this explains why assets are sticky in many funds that are more expensive relative to other ones. If we could get into the case for emerging markets a bit more. So emerging markets in particular over the last 2 years have really shown nothing in the way of gains, whereas U.S. Markets have obviously shown massive gains over that period. Beyond just a reversion to the mean here, what's the long case for emerging markets as we head into 2021 and beyond?
Right. So, you know, as I mentioned, it's been a difficult past decade for emerging markets. And I think a couple of themes that drove that underperformance goes back to, you know, commodity cycle. I think you know, not only energy, but also materials really had a difficult period between like 2014, 2016. There was a strengthening dollar over this time period. And really, I think a lot of the investment community really gravitated towards, you know, high growth and tech, while, you know, emerging markets in more towards value underperformed during that time. So, you know, favorably, with that being said, right now, IMG is at all-time high. It's broken out, going back to its, you know, its trading range. And I think the, you know, the outlook is really improved, you know, in the context of obviously the unprecedented, you know, COVID crisis, but also the extreme volatility we had over the past year. I think that, you know, coming in, you know, in the early part of 2021, it's really an area that, where the outlook has improved. Not only are commodity prices, you know, climbing, energy is kind of strengthening. China is an area that has been an area of strong economic growth over the past year. In contrast to the rest of the world, they were able to control a pandemic and their economy, you know, is already on a firmer footing. You know, for emerging markets, I think that there's not only value for companies that are still beaten down from volatility over the past year, but there's a lot of other themes such as the dollar weakening right now. And I think that's something that I expect to continue. So with that, it's a great way for investors to gain exposure, not only to, you know, a really strong area of international stocks, but to, you know, capture the exposure of a weakening dollar that will appreciate foreign stocks.
Particularly in terms of IEMG, so it makes total sense that one would choose that fund over, let's say, EEM. You're getting, in the case of IEMG, a fund that charges only 11 basis points. It's got over 2,500 holdings. EEM has under half that number, just a little over 1,200 holdings. There are other funds out there, particularly VWO, that cost roughly the same as IEMG. I think that fund's actually 10 basis points at this point, equally liquid from a trading standpoint. And I should point out, I'm also long IEMG here, so I've made this same decision clearly. But why IEMG over some of those peers like VWO, like SCHE, the Schwab Emerging Markets ETF?
Right. So you mentioned, you know, EEM, I think, you know, is the more well-known fund in this category. And I think that maybe a lot of investors that aren't particularly familiar with other options might gravitate towards EEM, but I believe IEMG is a stronger option. So as you mentioned, lower expense ratio, it's going to have a higher yield, dividend yield. And I think that its holdings at around, you know, 2,500 is really a sweet spot between, you know, with a smaller portfolio, more concentrated in EEM, and what is actually almost twice as large in VWO. So, you know, with that, I think you're capturing some exposure to the emerging market small caps, you know, some of the periphery, you know, countries and regions of emerging markets. It's, you know, it's in there. And really, you know, what really sold me, I think, is the, you know, the historical outperformance. I mean, IEMG is just has been able to deliver strong returns in this category. And I think that, you know, let's stick with the winners. And I think this is a fund that I expect to capture market share from EEM and VWO in terms of fund flows, as people realize that this is just a better option for long-term holding with the right size and the diversification you're getting. So maybe right now there is some, I would comment that EEM is a little bit more, has more like intraday trading liquidity. So, you know, kind of short-term traders might be, you know, attracts that. But I think that IEMG is, you know, if as a long-term holding in your portfolio, you're going to capture more of the trends that you want.
Sure. And then one key difference I would point out between, let's say, IEMG and VWO, these really are the two largest funds in the space by far at this point. No liquidity issues on either of them. If you look at the sector breakdown of IEMG, the biggest sector is technology at over 20%. After that, you've got financials at 17%. If you look at VWO, financials are the largest sector, almost 19%, then consumer cyclicals, and then technology is in third place at a little over 15%. So that definitely is a significant difference there. And I would tend to favor the more heavy weightings to technology. Also, you think about the kind of massive outperformers in the US and in Europe, and you look globally at China also. it really is the tech plays. So whether it's Alibaba or Tencent, or whether it's getting beyond China, companies like Taiwan Semiconductor, these are I think companies with very bright futures. And then I guess one other difference I would point out is that iShares Core MSCI Emerging Markets ETF, IEMG, is an MSCI fund. And so you get Samsung, you get Korea in the portfolio, whereas Vanguard is a FTSE fund. I'm fairly certain FTSE no longer classifies Korea as an emerging market. And so if you want that exposure, you have to now pick up another fund also. So I'm going to just double check that. But that's, I think, another thing for people to keep in mind here when looking at the different funds. And honestly, I think they're probably both pretty good choices. They're low cost, they're diversified. You get a lot of great companies in each of them.
Right. So, you know, you mentioned China. It's the largest country exposure in emerging markets. And I think that sometimes people look at that and say, wow, you know, that's a lot of China in the portfolio, upwards of 30%. But the reality is, you know, emerging markets is, it's sort of the, you know, the dog and the tail, you know, a picture where, you know, I think emerging market depends on China. China depends on the other emerging market countries. So it's a symbiotic relationship. And I think that, you know, the attraction of China is not only is the economy continues to be represent the, you know, strong economic growth, you know, globally, which is really impressive for the past, you know, 20 years, but, you know, they've beginning to bring, you know, to the table really market leaders in technology, as you mentioned. So there's nothing wrong with technology, and whether it's, you know, Chinese or Korean, you know, India, obviously a lot of these countries have technology firms. It's still a very important, you know, sector. And I think that, you know, one of the benefits is that these technology firms, they're operating in these markets that have higher economic growth, right? So, you know, just fundamentally beyond, you know, the global trends in technology and adoption of, you know, mobile and all these other themes, just there's higher economic growth to work with, expanding middle class. And these are kind of structural themes that have been and will continue to be the advantage in emerging markets. So it's you know, if you like, you know, Mexico, Chile, Brazil, you know, it's all in there. And I think that this scenario where, you know, I think the time has come where it's going to be, you know, the decade, you know, could be the decade for emerging markets, where a lot of investors will really appreciate having that exposure in their portfolios.
Makes a lot of sense. And I did just confirm that MSCI has continued to classify South Korea as an emerging market, whereas FTSE doesn't. So in IEMG, you also get your Korea exposure, and it's going to be relatively large in a cap-weighted index because of the size of the capital markets there. Whereas in VWO and the Vanguard equivalent, you end up with less exposure. You end up with no exposure in VWO. You end up having to buy Vanguard or whoever else is using FTSE Russell as an indexer. You have to buy their developed market fund to get access to South Korean markets. And of course, they're going to be less of a weighting there. So another thing to keep in mind, just for people that are trying to understand the differences between key funds here. And again, just to point out, I obviously came to the same decision as you because I am long IEMG myself right now for my emerging markets exposure. I am speaking with Books Research, who runs the Conviction Dossier Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. You can sign up for Conviction Dossier either by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for Conviction Dossier there, or by typing Conviction Dossier or Books Research into the search bar at the top of the site. I'd love to move on to your second pick here for the upcoming year, and we're going to pivot away from equities over to treasuries, to fixed income, different asset class. What is your pick in this space for 2021?
Right. So this is an interesting ETF, the ProShares Short 20-Year Treasury. Obviously, you know, short there implies it's kind of a bearish bond fund. Okay. So
sure. And just to point out to people listening, this the ticker symbol is TBF.
Right. So it's an inverse bond fund. And this actually is the inverse of a very popular ETF, TLT. So if TLT, which is the 20-plus-year treasury long fund, you know, declines, TBF will climb on a 1-to-1 ratio. And I think that the inverse there, the non-leveraged aspect here is kind of limits the risk of a, you know, the inverse exposure. And I think that it's a high quality fund. And I think that in the environment we're in right now, it's something that investors, you know, need to take a deeper look at.
So it's true that right now government bond yields are still basically at historic lows. They've climbed a bit over the last few weeks, but we're still talking about an incredibly flat yield curve. We're talking about historic lows in the U.S., of course, in Europe and Japan also, but the U.S. is headed in the same direction. With the current economic landscape and the likelihood for massive additional stimulus, now that the Democrats have also captured both houses of Congress, I'm just curious what you're thinking behind a pick which shorts treasuries and thus is a bet on rates going up at the long end of the curve with limited economic growth on the horizon and the likelihood for a continued depression of the dollar with all that stimulus coming out.
Right. So, you know, the 10-year treasury yield, I think, hit a low of 0.5% this cycle. This was back in around August. I think that that's a level where I believe we, you know, without being dramatic, we might not see again for, you know, many years possibly. And I think that in the environment of, as you mentioned, still near historically low interest rates, I believe that there's still room for the long end of the curve, you know, to climb higher. Right. So, you know, even TLT, which, you know, like I mentioned, it's one of the most popular, you know, bond funds and has done great over the past decade. You know, realistically, it's down almost 20% from its highs of 2020. So that means that's the reflection of the long end of the curve, you know, that steady climb higher, right? So I'm bullish on TBF, not necessarily because I expect a blowout in rates and an apocalyptic hyperinflationary environment, but I believe that we've seen the lows in long-term yields, and I think that it's really an option for investors to not only, you know, capture that upside in yields, the, you know, a little bit of a bond sell-off, but it can also work to, you know, hedge existing, you know, fixed income holdings, and it's a great ETF that I believe can generate some alpha in 2021.
Sure. And just to be clear, so people understand, it wouldn't take all that much. So if, let's say, the blended rate on the bond issues that are represented in 20 plus, if the blended rate goes up just 1%, what does that do in terms of the underlying value of the bonds? How many percentage points would it push them down and thus benefit TBF?
You know, I think if you can approximate, okay, we'll get a little bit technical with, you know, the concept of duration, which is the exposure to interest rate sensitivity. I think in a scenario, okay, where the long end of the treasury curve, you know, climbs, you know, just 0.5%. So from obviously a lot of people will focus on the 10-year, the 30-year. So the 30-year treasury, U.S. 30-year treasury now is at 1.85%. And that compares to 1.25% back in August, right? So that's, that's almost a 60 basis point, you know, rise over the past, you know, 6 months about with the, you know, and over the time frame, you know, we have TBF climbing nearly 15%, right? So I think that with the duration of about 20 inversely for a 1% rise in the 30-year treasury rate, you're going to see, you know, this fund has 30% upside in that scenario. And I think that that's obviously a pretty impressive upside potential, but it's in the context of, you know, interest rates that at the long end of the curve, they can be volatile. You know, they can have wide ranges. It's just a reality of the environment we're at, where, as you mentioned, record amounts of stimulus efforts from 2020, you know, are really set to continue. We have the new Biden administration already talking about a new round of economic stimulus package, potentially an infrastructure package. The Fed is set to continue, you know, QE. Really, it's just that wave of liquidity into the market, and the consequence of that, you know, comes back down to inflation. So, you know, even today we got the December CPI, you know, US CPI for December at 1.4%. Now, of course, 1.4% is pretty, you know, reasonable, but, you know, that's up from 1.2% in November. And I think that if, you know, at the rate we're going, you know, we could see the CPI heading, you know, above 2% on an annualized basis over the next year. And I think that that's just creates this pressure where, you know, the market begins to price, you know, higher and higher long-term bond yields down the line. And I think that's going to be reflected in higher rates, which can support the upside in the TBF ETF.
So I'd love to move over to more of a tactical or logistical question here. And that is that the marketing or the kind of warning that comes on not only leverage, but also single inverse funds is that they're meant to provide exposure over short-term periods of time. And that due to the risk of compounding and the way that the exposure is created through swaps that are reset at the end of each trading day to make sure they're offering the right amount of exposure. So in this case, it would be single inverse, that there is somewhat of a risk to holding something like TBF longer term. Now, I've looked at this in terms of single inverse ETFs, and there's definitely a lot less of a compounding eating away at potential longer term returns. But what's your thinking about holding something like this indefinitely, or do you start keeping an eye on slippage from that kind of one-to-one performance over longer periods of time and maybe cut bait at some point as a result of that?
Right. So, you know, we spoke about earlier having a little bit of a, you know, tactical positioning in a portfolio, you know, beyond kind of long-term core holdings. And I think, you know, TBF is a great example of that, where, you know, something, you know, across, you know, 6 to 1 year outlook, I think is where, you know, this fund would fit in. And look, you know, if yields are going to climb, if the, you know, 10, 30 year treasury rate is going to go higher, which is very possible, and the TBF ETF, you know, keeps climbing, people will not be complaining, right? So I think that this is a case where, you know, investors, you know, obviously can consider a small position in the context of a diversified portfolio, maybe average in, you know, with an allocation over, you know, days, weeks to kind of capture a better cost basis. And I think that it's something that, you know, just one of these ETFs that that are unique in the market that offers a very specific exposure that, you know, very targeted, that I think it's an area where, you know, it's going to be getting a lot more attention if, you know, yields, you know, continue to climb. So you're right. There is a little bit of a risk with the aspect of, you know, ETF unit creation and, you know, the rollover of the swaps. But I think that it's, you know, in the environment, in the current environment and, you know, the outlook that I have, I think that it, over the next, you know, 6 months, you know, to 1 year, it should do okay.
All right. Awesome. No, that's a great response there. And again, you did choose the single inverse and not one of the leverage.
Right. There's versions. Also, I would mention for more aggressive traders, people that, you know, want to take a little bit higher risk, you know, TBT is the sister or companion fund of the same fund family, which is leveraged 2X, right? And that one is going to obviously have, you know, twice the volatility, you know, twice the risk. But, you know, if you're an investor that believes that, you know, that inflation can surprise to the upside and that there is, you know, room for, you know, yields to climb higher, than TBF is a relatively more conservative than TBT. So I think that both of them are very interesting funds, but my pick is going to be TBF given the more attractive reward to risk setup.
All right, so let's move over to your third pick here, and considering the run up that tech has had, I think this is a relatively bold call to some extent. So what is the fund, first of all?
Okay, this is the Vanguard International Dividend Appreciation ETF. Okay, the ticker symbol is VIGI. So you're right. There is some exposure to tech, but this is a global, you know, another foreign ETF, another, you know, global stock equity ETF. And I think that a little different from IEMG, but I think that they both, you know, can complement each other with a little bit different, you know, with a different strategy.
Sure. And I guess there's probably some exposure to tech, but because it's dividend appreciation, it's generally going to be a lot of overlap with value. It's not going to be a very growth heavy kind of a fund in terms of its exposures. Companies that can grow their dividends every single year for many, many years in a row. And obviously, the story of the last decade has been growth's absolute trouncing of value. There's been many kind of head fakes or people making calls saying, well, now it's value's turn to take over, but it simply hasn't materialized to date. And so I'm curious, what is the case for international dividend growers in particular here? And why you've selected this fund.
Viggy, I will call it Viggy. I'm not sure if they pronounce it as like, you know, Viggy or Viggy.
I think it's Viggy because the US one, V-I-G, Vig.
Yeah. So Viggy, right? So the international, and it's actually seven years of dividend appreciation. And,
okay, that's,
you know,
all it is. Okay, good.
And this is actually one of my favorite ETFs. It's my for long-term holding. I think this is a great way for investors to capture just exposure to international stocks. So if you're an investor that has a portfolio, you know, centered around, you know, US companies and US ETFs, this is a great way to move beyond that. And the attraction here is that the aspect of dividend appreciation kind of works as a fundamental screen. Okay. So the fund is looking at international stocks that, you know, specifically that have been able to grow their dividends for the past 7 years consecutively. And what does that imply? That implied these companies obviously, you know, have, you know, had relatively strong financials. They have, balance sheets that can support, you know, dividend payouts. So it's so that aspect of where there's a fundamental screen to dividend appreciation in the aspect of dividend appreciation, I think is, you know, really adds to the quality of the companies within the portfolio, right? So one of the challenges in international stocks is that, you know, outside of emerging markets and in areas like, you know, like Asia, for example, you know, we have Europe. And the problem with Europe is that because economic growth is, you know, is weak in Europe, a lot of the, you know, the equity returns in that region have been pretty, you know, pretty low for the past several years. And obviously there's even, you know, low interest rates. It hasn't been a very strong equity region, you know, for a long time. So Viggy can go into Europe, goes into other regions, like including emerging markets, you know, the Middle East, and is selecting the companies that are, you know, growing dividends, that have value, that are, you know, that are fundamentally screened. I think that creates a strong portfolio of companies that are, you know, that are consolidating their leadership position, right? So that's on this ETF, you know, includes some of the same emerging market holdings we talked about in IEMG, but it goes beyond that, you know, for with over 50% in European stocks. So for European stocks, it's a great opportunity to capture just you know, a little bit higher quality, more conservative, you know, region of equities, but, you know, with the growth component.
Yeah, sure. Makes total sense. And there's actually relatively little overlap to IEMG. So it's true Tencent is the top holding here. But once you get beyond that, you're looking at everything from luxury brands like LVMH, Moët Hennessy, to Nestle, to Roche, to Novartis. You've got really L'Oreal. You've got a lot of very well-known European brands here that have been around for a very long time and maybe haven't been in the public eye as much as FANG stocks or stocks like Alibaba, but have managed to continue growing their dividends, their ability to return cash to shareholders. And so definitely a very interesting selection and different than kind of the standard run of the mill, just Europe exposure. So if I'm like VEA, which I'm long, which doesn't really focus on dividends at all, just focuses on developed ex-US. In terms of the US equivalent of this fund, the Vanguard Dividend Appreciation ETF, ticker symbol VIG, is a very popular fund at this point, particularly with the dividend growth crowd. Is this a fund that you've looked at and would recommend also, or is this specific to ex-US international exposure in some way?
Right. So VIGI is going to be kind of a, you know, the international companion to the US Vanguard Dividend Appreciation ETF, VIG, that, as you mentioned. And to me, it's really a case where I believe, you know, international stocks with a, in an environment of a weakening US dollar, you know, can outperform, you know, this year, right? So I tend to favor VIGI. Obviously, you know, if we're in a scenario where, you know, economic growth is strong, you know, the vaccine, you know, effectively ends the pandemic, I think it should be positive for equity markets overall. But I would bet that there could be more upside in VIGI over the US equivalent. So they're great funds. I think that dividend appreciation is a very powerful factor for equity returns, and that's been academically, you know, tested and researched, and it's a real driver of returns for investors. And I think that, you know, these funds that deliver kind of the fundamental screen to kind of, you know, weed out companies that are, you know, obviously can't pay dividends or have balance sheet problems, earnings problems, I think that it really creates a higher quality portfolio. So this is an ETF, you know, VIGI, that I think is, you know, is a great option for investors to diversify into foreign stocks.
Nice. That's great. Anyway, Books, I want to thank you for being so generous with your time here today. I think you've got some great picks for listeners to mull over, research further. For people that want to find you online or follow your work, where's the best place for them to do that? Obviously, the first thing to do is go to seekingalpha.com. Type Books research into the search bar at the top of the site, follow you so that you get alerted when you put new things out. Where else can people follow you?
Yes. You know, so I've been a really kind of a regular contributor recently. I've been producing a lot of work, and I think that I'm really appreciating the opportunity to improve my writing skills. I think if you look back at probably over 500 articles in the past couple of years, I think that there's been I really refined my writing, you know, skill set. And I think that I'm able to put ideas together, you know, pretty concisely for readers. I hope they enjoy that.
Nice. I'm sure our editorial team will be very happy to hear that they've upped your writing game.
One of the things I'm looking forward to this year is starting a YouTube channel. Okay. So I think that that's on my list to do. And I hope that, you know, people that are familiar with our work on Seeking Alpha can, you know, can see some videos and where we can maybe dive into some new ideas. But I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. It was a great conversation, and till next time.
For disclosures, Books research is long IEMG, TBF, and VIGI. Jonathan List is long IEMG, EBIZ, CIBR, and VEA. If you've been enjoying Let's Talk ETFs, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. And if you find this podcast useful, please consider leaving a review on one of those platforms so that other investors can discover it. You can also find this podcast on seekingalpha.com by typing Let's Talk ETFs into the search bar at the top of the site.